Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Progressive groups, including the New York Civil Liberties Union, say they are frustrated that action on left-leaning issues has stalled in New York in the final weeks of the legislative session. They held a rally to get Democrats who lead the state Senate and Assembly to move faster on items like granting driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants and workers' rights for farm laborers. More from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
Donna Lieberman, executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, says the first legislative session to be run by Democrats in a decade has already seen many successes. They include passage of the Reproductive Health Act. It codified the rights in the landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade into New York state law. Also, approval of the DREAM Act, which grants access to college aid for the children of undocumented immigrants, strengthened voting rights, and bail reform.
After decades and decades of being kind of do-nothing-ish in the New York State Legislature, we have a legislature that was elected to do something to fight for justice.
But she and other advocates say there's still unfinished business before the session ends, including what's known as the Green Light campaign to permit undocumented immigrants to obtain standard driver's licenses.
It's time to reverse the ridiculously harmful and unsafe policy of denying people driver's license based on their immigration status.
The group is also seeking passage of a bill to give farm workers more rights. Students in the NYCLU's Teen Activist Project also spoke at the rally. Anna Bedell, a high school student in New York City, spoke in favor of the Healthy Students, Healthy Schools bill. It would mandate better sex education for the state's teenagers.
Most of the time, the sex ed that we are taught is about sex between straight cis couples, when in reality, many teens do not fit this narrative. Who do LGBTQ+ identified students go to when they have questions about their sexuality and relationships when the curriculum excludes them?
Ben Platt spoke against the increasing use of identifying software technology in schools.
Every day, from the moment I enter school, I have no expectation of privacy whatsoever. I swipe my ID so school administrators know exactly when I enter and leave. Cameras line the hallways, assiduously tracking my every move, despite my school having almost no disciplinary incidents.
Teenagers at the rally support a bill that would ban facial recognition and other biosurveillance technologies in public schools. He says there are better ways to ensure student safety. Since the state budget was approved in late March, action has stalled on a number of issues, including the driver's license and farm workers' bills, as well as on legalizing marijuana for adult recreational use. Supporters have not given up hope. Lieberman says it might actually be a good sign that lawmakers seem to be deliberating and considering the bills more carefully.
There's still, as we go around and talk to people, a lot of energy and a lot of commitment to try to get things done, and there are a number of our issues, I think, remain in play.
She says, after all, a lot can happen in the 5 weeks remaining in the session. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
New York U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand introduced legislation this week with a Republican counterpart that would require the Environmental Protection Agency to establish an enforceable standard under the Safe Drinking Water Act for per- and polyfluorokill substances, or PFAS, in drinking water. Specifically, the legislation would require the EPA to set a maximum contaminant level in primary national drinking water regulation for PFAS chemicals within 2 years of the bill becoming law. Meanwhile, last week, two upstate New York congressmen introduced bills also aimed at protecting the public from exposure to PFAS chemicals, which have contaminated water supplies in communities across the Northeast. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard.
Representative Antonio Delgado of the 19th District and Representative Sean Patrick Maloney of the 18th, both Democrats, this week introduced bills focused on polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS. Delgado, whose district includes Hoosick Falls and Petersburg, two communities with groundwater contamination, says he's seen the impacts firsthand. He spoke earlier this year on the health effects associated with exposure to PFAS chemicals.
We're talking about, you know, cancer here, thyroid, kidney. These are the things that people have succumbed to, and even just unknown health consequences.
Along with Democratic Representative Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, Democrat Dan Kildee of Michigan, and Republican Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, Delgado is introducing a bill that would require PFAS substances to be listed on the toxic release inventory at the Environmental Protection Agency. This would require manufacturers, processors, and producers to report their usage of PFAS chemicals, which is then made publicly available. Former EPA Region 2 Administrator Judith Eng says because the TRI reporting is voluntary, it could be seen as a weakness in the law.
But it's also realistic because there are literally tens of thousands of major polluters in the United States, and Congress does not give EPA enough money to go out and do testing themselves. So a lot of environmental regulation is self-reporting. And I think it's important to expand the list of chemicals that are reported on. Think of this as a right-to-know law.
Representative Sean Patrick Maloney represents the city of Newburgh, which has seen PFOS contamination of its water supply linked to firefighting foam used at Stewart Air National Guard Base. Maloney introduced a bill that would require chemicals like PFOS, PFOA, and Gen X to be tested under the Toxic Substances Control Act. When the act was passed by Congress in the 1970s, tens of thousands of chemicals were grandfathered in, limiting the ability of government agencies to test for or investigate them. Maloney's bill would direct EPA to conduct testing of all per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances and make the results public. Last year, Maloney authored a provision to require the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to conduct a study on the long-term health effects of PFOA and PFOS exposure. Here's Maloney speaking on WAMC's Congressional Corner earlier this week.
I passed legislation to have research done on the federal level so we know what the safe level is of PFOA and PFOS in human blood, if any, because this is a big national problem, not just here.
Eng says Maloney's latest proposal is a little redundant, but said getting federal agencies to act on issues can be slow. She says a directive from Congress with funding and a deadline is important.
I mean, the sad reality is the people of Newburgh and Hoosick Falls and Petersburg are essentially guinea pigs. There's a lot of environmental exposure, very little to prevent that exposure. And now there's a shift toward testing what are the long-term health impacts of being exposed to these contaminants. I think it's good to get these bills introduced. We need to see bipartisan support. These chemicals are the new PCBs, and they're just not getting enough attention.
Today, residents of Hoosick Falls and Newburgh have PFAS-free municipal water, and searches for new water supplies continue. But Maloney's office estimates 19 million Americans across the country have PFAS chemicals in their drinking water. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. Lots to talk about this weekend. Let's start with the Republican Party. Of course, the head of that party is Ed Cox, and he has been the head of the party for quite a long time now, and as a result, he now has a challenger. His name is Nick Langworthy. He's the head of the GOP in Erie County, and he's picked up quite a few endorsements already in what seems to be shaping up to be quite a contest.
Well, look, on a personal level, I really like Ed Cox. He has been very forthcoming, coming on this radio station and giving us long interviews and discussions. It's a blue state. The poor guy, you know, there's a limit on what he can do. But what happened here is that the state Senate went Democratic, and that has opened the floodgates to progressive and other kinds of legislation. And there's a lot of anger out there among Republicans. Well, when you can't do anything, well, what you do is you come along and you say, okay, out with the old, in with the new. However, Cox has done such a good job as a manager of resources, and he's no slouch when it comes to making the arguments about Republicans versus Democrats, that it's going to be very hard to replace him. Can it happen? Yes, it could. Will it be a more conservative Republican Party, and will that help them? Will it make them winners as opposed to losers? No, it will not. But sometimes when you need a fall guy, you find one.
The back and forth over whether to legalize recreational use of marijuana has been something to watch this session, as it started out on the fast track and then got into a very complicated area where a number of things needed to be decided before it was made into law. And just late this week, we heard from the head of the state Senate, Andrea Stewart Cousins, about state lawmakers who are now supporting legislation, a new bill after that failed effort, which largely reflects what Governor Andrew Cuomo proposed in his initial budget in January. Now it looks like we're on the yes side of whether it'll happen.
Well, we don't know. We know that Massachusetts is eating New York's lunch. They're taking it all in. The lines, I live in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, the lines outside the first of these places is just unrelenting. It just doesn't stop. That's money for the town, it's money for the state, and Andrew Cuomo is all about money. Now, somehow, there's a fight between the state legislature, the two houses, which are Democratic now, and the governor. I just want to make sure in my own head that I believe Cuomo is really for it. I have a feeling he's the old Cuomo who is against it. But who knows? Your words may be prophetic. It may be that the legislature, which had its problems with the Cuomo approach, have changed their minds, and it'll happen. And it might happen because they need the money. And I know Andrew Cuomo was counting on it. On the other hand, if he doesn't want it, he'll find an excuse for not having it.
You often interact with the editor of the Times Union, Rex Smith, for the Media Project program. He calls these stories golly Marthas. That's when you look at a story and say, yep. Whoa, golly Martha, do you see that? Now, how about the idea that in the state Senate this week, they backed a bill which will prohibit 3D printed guns in New York? This is where we are now with technology and the idea that you could print a gun and it would be non-traceable.
Well, you know, David, you really have asked a very interesting question. The fact of the matter is we're loaded with guns that are illegal to begin with. They come from the South. They come in people's trunks. They come one way or the other. Now we're saying this is so bad that we won't be able to trace the guns. Well, the crooks don't care. They're going to keep making them one way or another. It is a good idea. I think it's a good idea to say that you can't print guns. On the other hand, guns are a fact of our life, and they are awful, just awful. The carnage goes on.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. An agency that offers disability and mental health services in New York's Hudson Valley has opened two new urgent care centers in Orange County. The agency's president believes they are the first of their kind in the region, if not the state. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn explains.
Access Supports for Living has opened a mental health and substance use urgent care in Middletown and Newburgh. Access CEO Ron Colavito describes the mental health and substance use urgent care as a front door to care.
You don't have to be in full-scale mental health or substance abuse crisis to walk in. You know, there could be, you know, depression or anxiety, you know, all the way up to, you know, suicidal thoughts or, you know, significant addiction issues. But it can be anywhere along that spectrum.
And with the support of a $4 million grant awarded through the U.S. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, there will be no charge for services not covered by insurance.
We've served every person that's come in with, you know, without long wait times, you know, reasonable wait times. People are engaged when they come in the door. We have a peer, someone with, you know, lived experience in mental health or substance abuse that can engage with a person. And then they have access to, you know, both nursing and clinical, licensed clinical supports.
Adults and children with mental health and or substance use concerns can walk in with no appointment or referral necessary and begin treatment, including medication-assisted treatment for addiction to drugs or alcohol. The Mental Health and Substance Use Urgent Care Team includes psychiatrists, licensed therapists, registered nurses, peers, care managers, and a nutritionist. Brian Doyle is CEO of Family Services, whose main office is in Poughkeepsie. He supports the urgent care model and agrees there is a need.
I don't have to tell you that substance use disorders are increasing, and all the more reason for such a resource to be opened in Orange County.
As more people become aware of and use the service, Colavito says hours and staffing could change to meet any needs down the road.
We've seen, you know, on light days, you know, around 6 or so people, but I think the other day we had 25 people.
That's been since the opening May 1st, the start of Mental Health Awareness Month.
The majority of people we are seeing are people that we were not previously connected to.
Colavito addresses potential expansion.
So, I mean, first and foremost, we definitely want to, you know, continue the advocacy that this model is sustained so that these models survive, you know, the ones that we've started into the future. But, you know, I think in our surrounding, you know, counties, region, state, and nationally, this becoming, you know, a model is really important. We would love to do more in our communities that we serve and are definitely willing and, you know, and able to talk to others about, you know, how they could go around implementing this. People helped us, so we would definitely be, you know, willing to help others.
Family Services Doyle.
Well, as a matter of fact, we have recently discussed this internally, and in as much as Family Services and Hudson Valley Mental Health are now a merged entity, we're taking a look at services such as this and resources such as this that may be a benefit to people in Ulster or Dutchess counties.
The Access Mental Health and Substance Use Urgent Care is open to residents from across the Hudson Valley 7 days a week, Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. The locations are Union Street Community Counseling Center in Middletown and Kaplan Family Counseling Center on Grand Street in Newburgh.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A newly released study ranks New York above the national average in health emergency preparedness. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports the study tracked response readiness from tornadoes to terrorism to tuberculosis.
Is New York prepared to handle a major public health crisis? Glenn Mays is a professor of health policy who leads a team of researchers at the University of Kentucky that developed the National Health Security Preparedness Index through various sources.
Everything from having surveillance capabilities to detect diseases and health risks in the environment early on so we can stop them before they harm lots of people, to looking at the quality of our medical care delivery systems, hospitals, nursing homes, mental health, and others to make sure they're ready and prepared to respond to a potential surge in demand for care, and also looking at places like schools and work sites and making sure they have plans in place, they're prepared to respond in the event of an emergency.
The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's annual assessment of day-to-day emergency readiness shows the Empire State fares better than the rest of the country. On a scale of 10, New York scored 6.9, compared with 6.7 for the U.S. as a whole.
Significantly above the national average. And you're in a region of Northeast states that are kind of leading the nation in a lot of these kinds of health protections. So that's something that New Yorkers can feel good about.
Connecticut also scored 6.9, while Massachusetts led the nation with a score of 7.4. Vermont received 7.2. Hayes explains the index measures 129 different areas, from the condition of critical infrastructure to the ability to monitor, detect, and identify threats to public health.
The good news is that we're improving over time as a nation and in New York as well, but we still have a lot of room for improvement. Again, our national score is 6.7 on a 0 to 10 scale, so we've got about two-thirds of the protections in place that we might want to have to be maximally prepared. Our weakest area as a nation actually is in healthcare delivery.
The single category New York scored poorly in. Hayes offers recommendations for remediation.
One is to get more healthcare organizations and providers engage in preparedness planning and conducting exercises and drills on a collaborative basis, not just one hospital at a time or one nursing home at a time, but getting our facilities and professionals networked together and doing these plans and exercises and drills practicing together. We don't have nearly as much participation in these regional preparedness coalitions and networks as we need to. We understand hospitals also have to compete with each other in the market for healthcare services, but for preparedness, we need to collaborate, not compete.
Samantha Penta, an assistant professor in the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, suggests using the data as a guideline to see where our attention should be focused.
So one of the things that's highlighted is a general trend of increasing preparedness across the country over the last few years. Which is good to see. We want to see that improving, right? But then the other thing is looking at, well, then what is keeping us from improving more, and using that to focus our attention on where we should be working next. The real thing to keep in mind with these kinds of indices is less about the accomplishment of achieving a certain number, and really as a guidepost for thinking about how can we continue to make our communities even safer.
93% of 247 emergency physicians responding to a 2018 poll conducted by the American College of Emergency Physicians said their emergency departments are not fully prepared for surge capacity during a disaster. The New York State Department of Health did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Tracking readiness for disasters, outbreaks, and emergencies that threaten health and well-being, the National Health Security Preparedness Index is compiled from data gathered from more than 60 sources measuring preparedness for unforeseen occurrences, including disease outbreak, terrorism, and extreme weather conditions. There's a link at WAMC.org.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
The Olympic Regional Development Authority, or ORDA, is beginning renovation of several of its Olympic sites after a $70 million appropriation for capital improvements was approved in the New York State budget. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley reports.
Permits have been approved and contracts awarded for upgrades at the Olympic Ski Jumping Complex in Lake Placid. ORDA spokesman John Lundeen says the last upgrades to the ski jumps came back in 1994.
In order for, you know, Lake Placid to continue to be a player in international competition, and in this case, ski jumping, you know, we need to continue to make sure that these ski jumps are up to the international standards that will attract, whether it be national competition, major international competitions like a World Cup, or, you know, we're looking forward to 2023 and the World University Games.
The project includes new infrastructure for the jumps, such as the installation of frost rails that maintain a consistent surface. Underground infrastructure is being upgraded, and the outrun landing hills are being redesigned. New amenities for visitors will be created. The chairlift will be replaced with a new gondola. A new glass-enclosed elevator will take people to the top of the 120-meter jump. And a four-cable zip line adjacent to the ski jumps is planned. Regional Office of Sustainable Tourism President Jim McKenna says the upgrades serve a dual purpose.
That's going to catapult us back into world-class ski jumping. So from an athletic point of view and a world sports point of view, that's very significant. The second thing is that, you know, the ski jumps are sort of a very iconic thing in this region. But it was built for athletes. Now, with the gondola built in, with doing a new glass enclosed elevator, and most importantly, the zip line, it will allow for some new visitor and traveler activities and, you know, separating us from the crowd. How many places in the world have a zip line coming off a ski jump? There is one other, by the way.
Lundeen notes that as work begins at the ski jumps, plans are moving forward to upgrade venues at Mount Van Hovenberg.
We'll soon begin capital projects at Mount Van Hovenberg, the cross-country venue. The big thing there is going to be the new base lodge, which will serve as a welcome center, base lodge, and a new start sliding facility for the sports of bobsled and skeleton. There's going to be a biathlon Nordic stadium, 5K worth of new trails as well. And this is twofold. One, we're doing this for sport. We're looking forward to the World University Games in 2023. And two, to enhance the guest experience.
The zip line, gondola, and elevator projects are projected to be completed by the fall. Renovations related to international sporting will continue through next year. During its upcoming May meeting, the Adirondack Park Agency will review modifications to previously authorized improvements at Ordis Ski Jumping Complex.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1920. Or just listen or podcast on the web at WAMC.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.